नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय This morning we're going to be reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, first chapter, text number 4 through 7. And the given topic is the science of chanting and hearing. So we'll chant together and read text number 4, and then we'll read the translations to 5, 6, and 7, and then during the class we'll cover different topics brought up in the purports to 5, 6, and 7. So word meanings, Naimishe, in the forest known as Naimisharanya, Animisha Kshetre, the spot which is especially a favorite of Vishnu, who does not close his eyelids, Rashaya, sages, Shonaka Adaya, headed by the sage Shonaka, Shatram, sacrifice, Svargaya, the Lord who is glorified in heaven, Lokaya, for the devotees who are always in touch with the Lord, Sahasra, 1,000 Sama years, Asata, performed. Naimishe, Naimisha, Kshetre, Rashaya, Shonakadaya, Satram, Svargaya, Lokaya, Sahasra Sama Asata Naimishe Nimisha Kshetre Rishaya Shonakadaya Satram Swargaya Lokaya Sahasra Sama Asata Someone else want to chant? I'll read the translation and maybe we can take turns reading the purport. Translation: once in a holy place in the forest of Naimisharanya, great sages headed by the sage Shonaka assembled to perform a great 1,000-year sacrifice for the satisfaction of the Lord and his devotees.
The prelude of the Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken in the previous three shlokas. Now the main topic of this great literature is being presented. Srimad Bhagavatam, after its first recitation by Srila Shukadeva Goswami, was repeated for the second time at Naimisharanya.
In the Vaiviha Tantra, it is said that Brahma, the engineer of this particular universe, contemplated a great wheel which could enclose the universe. The hub of this great circle was fixed at a particular place known as Naimisharanya. Similarly, there is another reference to the forest of Naimisharanya in the Varaha Purana, where it is stated that by performance of sacrifice at this place, the strength of demonic people is curtailed. The Brahmanas prefer Naimisharanya for such sacrificial performances.
The devotees of Lord Vishnu offer all kinds of sacrifices for his pleasure. The devotees are always attached to the service of the Lord, whereas fallen souls are attached to the pleasures of material existence. In Bhagavad Gita, it is said that anything performed in the material world for any reason other than for the pleasure of Lord Vishnu causes further bondage to the performer. It is enjoined therefore that all acts must be performed sacrificially for the satisfaction of Vishnu and his devotees. This will bring everyone peace and prosperity.
The great sages are always anxious to do good to the temple in general, and such as sages headed by Shonaka and others assemble at his holy places of Naimisharanya with a program of performing a great and continuous chain of sacrificial ceremonies. Forgetful men do not know the right path for peace and prosperity. However, the sages know it well, and therefore for the good of all men, they are always anxious to perform acts which may bring about peace in the world. They are sincere friends, acts which may bring about peace. They are sincere friends to all living entities, and at the risk of great personal inconvenience, they are always engaged in the service of the Lord for the good of all people. Lord Vishnu is just like a great tree, and all others, including the demigods, men, siddhas, charanas, vidyadharas, and other living entities, are like branches, twigs, and leaves of that tree. By pouring water on the root of the tree, all the parts of the tree are automatically nourished. Only those branches and leaves which are detached cannot be so satisfied. Detached branches and leaves dry up gradually despite all watering attempts. Similarly, human society, when it is detached from the personality of Godhead, like detached branches and leaves, is not capable of being watered, and one attempting to do so is simply wasting his energy and resources.
The modern materialistic society is detached from its relation to the Supreme Lord, and all its plans which are being made by atheist leaders are sure to be baffled at every step. Yet they do not wake up to this.
In this age, the congregational chanting of the holy names of the Lord is a prescribed method for waking up. The ways and means are most scientifically presented by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and intelligent persons may take advantage of his teachings in order to bring about real peace and prosperity. Srimad Bhagavatam is also presented for the same purpose, and this will be explained more specifically later in the text.
So, we'll just read these next three verses, and then we'll discuss text 5. One day, after finishing their morning duties by burning a sacrificial fire and offering a seat of esteem to Srila Suta Goswami, the great sages made inquiries with great respect about the following matters. The sages said, "Respected Suta Goswami, you are completely free from all vice. You are well versed in all the scriptures famous for religious life, and in the Puranas and histories as well, for you have gone through them under proper guidance and have also explained them. Being the eldest learned Vedantist, O Suta Goswami, You are acquainted with the knowledge of Vyasadeva, who is the incarnation of Godhead, and you also know other sages who are fully versed in all kinds of physical and metaphysical knowledge. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuru Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So the subject matter is the science of hearing and chanting, and the example of these sages and how they began their sacrifice is very relevant to us, and especially in Prabhupada's purport. There are several different points that we'll cover today that explain how we can execute the science of hearing and chanting in the correct way. And so there's one question I'd like you to think about as we go through all these things, and then maybe we can discuss that at the end. And that is, we have the sages here. They're gathered in the forest of Naimisharanya, and they're doing a fire yajna. They're making offerings into the fire, sacrificial fire. And the plan is to do that for quite some time, 1,000-year sacrifice. So how is what we're doing here today, and what we do every day, we come together to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, to discuss Srimad Bhagavatam. How is that similar to what the sages there were doing, and how is it different? So if you can think about that as we go through the different points, I think that we can get some valuable lessons from this series of verses. So the first thing that I wanted to point out was about knowledge itself. You may know that in the Vedic culture, in the Vedic tradition, especially in books like Manu Samhita and others, law books given by Manu, there's a prohibition about giving knowledge to society at large or widely in knowledge. It's sort of restricted. There's this conception of restricting knowledge to the Brahmin class. So are you familiar with this idea? You've heard of it before? Why do you think that that restriction was there? Why was this sort of idea that, well, knowledge is just for the Brahmins, it shouldn't be given to others? Anybody have an idea? Yes? Huh? Greed. Okay, yeah, that's interesting. Well, we come down the line next, Sagar. Others might not have the intelligence to grasp it. Okay. Inappropriate use of knowledge. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Half knowledge is dangerous. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Anybody? Yes. These are all good. Yeah. Yes. It's a misconception. Right. Yeah, I like all these the responses. Thank you. Basically, knowledge is power, and our approach to knowledge. When I say our, I mean say in Krishna consciousness or in the Vedic culture. Our approach to knowledge is different than what we find in society at large today. My experience has been, and this is an experience that from being a small boy, is that when people get in a position where they have knowledge, they can use that to exploit you. For instance, when I was, before I was even 10 years old, I had an older sister. And my older sister had some knowledge. She knew how to make brownies. And she definitely used that to control me and my brother. When my parents left, and she was in charge, she would have us do things. She would get us to do things. She would control us by her knowledge of how to make brownies. So right from the very young age, we're taught at least I was taught in this society, that if you have knowledge, you can control people. You can do things. I mean, who hasn't had the frustration of dealing with a car mechanic or something like that, right? Car mechanic, he knows how to fix your car, and he can tell you anything. Speaking of myself, I don't know anything about how a car works. So if something goes wrong with my car, I go to a car mechanic, he has the knowledge, he can tell me anything. And he can take advantage of me, have monetary gain based on my ignorance and his knowledge. And indeed, a lot of what passes as knowledge in the modern day is like this. It's used to exploit others. I wish Dina Bundu could was here. Did he take the Hippocratic Oath? They don't take it anymore. There it is. They don't take it anymore. Doctors used to take the oath that they're going to use their knowledge to benefit others. We should confirm that with him. Oh. Yeah, well, that's interesting. Yeah, Dina Bundu confirms that they don't take that oath anymore. Because that was an oath not to exploit, basically. You know, I have knowledge, I can, and I'm going to use that to benefit you. But if they don't take that anymore, that's scary. but the real purpose of knowledge is not to exploit others. The real purpose of knowledge is what these sages are doing here. They're sitting there, they're performing this sacrifice, which is a way of cultivating knowledge, and the purpose is for the benefit of all beings, not for the exploitation of others. And so I think that fear of this exploitative tendency, just as the Prabhu that spoke mentioned, fear of this exploitative tendency is why this idea came up about restricting knowledge to the Brahmins only. That others who were less qualified might use it inappropriately. Unfortunately, what happened in the Vedic culture, especially with the advent of Kali Yuga and this idea of restricting knowledge to the Brahmins, what happened with that? Yeah, they started exploiting others, right? And they started misusing it. And we have an example right in the Bhagavatam itself with when Maharaj Parikshit was cursed by the Brahmin boy. You know the story. The Brahmin boy felt his father was insulted by the king, and therefore he used his brahminical power to curse the king to die. And when his father found out about this, Shamaka Rishi, when he found out that his son had misused the power like this, he was very distressed, because he could understand that this was the entrance point for all the evils of Kali Yuga to come into the world, when Brahmins started misusing their power. So therefore, in these verses we see today, what they're doing is they're putting Suta Goswami on the seat of the Vyasasan from which knowledge is spoken, but there's much discussion by Srila Prabhupada in the purports and in the verses about the qualifications that are necessary to be able to deliver the knowledge. And they focus on two things, the character of the speaker and also some things about the knowledge itself. And so character is a very, very essential part of our understanding of having the fortune to be given this Vedic knowledge. It comes with certain character requirements. One of our acharyas, Haridas Thakur, you know, he was glorified for two reasons. Does anybody know the two reasons why Haridas Thakur was glorified? Nanda? He chanted many rounds. Certainly he was Namacharya.
Yes.
Yes, the two things. Gaudakanta, thank you. The two things about him. Lord Chaitanya said that some people behave nicely, but then they don't try to give knowledge to others. And other people give knowledge, try to give knowledge to others, but they don't behave nicely. But the glories of Haridas Thakur was he did both. He had a proper character, and he gave knowledge to others. And so that's the line we're coming in, and we see it reflected in these verses that Suta Goswami is given the seat, but the qualifications are necessary. And those qualifications are described in the sixth text, where the purport says, a Goswami, or the bona fide representative of Srila Vyasadeva, must be free from all kinds of vices. The four major vices of Kali Yuga are, 1, illicit connection with women, 2, animal slaughter, 3, intoxication, 4, speculative gambling of all sorts. A Goswami must be free from all these vices before he can dare to sit on the Vyasasan. No one should be allowed to sit on the Vyasasan who is not spotless in character and who is not freed from the above-mentioned vices. Now, you may ask, okay, then what are you doing sitting up there giving us the Bhagavatam class? You know, these are pretty high requirements that are listed here. Are you free from these things? Well, I can tell you that I'm trying to become free from them. Am I free from them? I can't say that I am. But we in the Krishna Consciousness Movement have been encouraged by Srila Prabhupada to share our realizations with others. Now, how is that? How is he asking us to share our realizations with others, yet he's writing such high qualifications of who can speak the Bhagavatam? Well, it comes in an understanding of the difference between two Sanskrit words. One is anukara, and the other is anusara. Any Sanskrit scholars who can give us the meaning of those two words? Anusara and anukara. Okay, well, just so that my wife can remain humble, we'll have Vaishnava tell us instead of her tell us.
Anusara means to follow the footsteps, and anuchara means to copy.
Right. Anusara means following the path given, by the instruction given by the Lord and his devotees. And anukara means imitation. So there's a very interesting story in the Mahabharata which sort of illustrates the difference between these two things. Apparently once there was a wealthy merchant that lived near the ocean who had a family and lived in a very pious and prosperous kingdom. And the sons of this merchant, they used to give the sort of the remnants of their food, which is a very rich, opulent food. You can imagine in a wealthy family, they had everything at their disposal. So they used to give the remnants of their food to this crow that would come there every day. They developed a little relation with the crow. And the crow was eating this and becoming nice and strong and healthy. And he also was becoming proud. You know, because he was eating such nice food compared to the other crows, he started to think that these other crows, I'm better than them. I'm better than all them. They eat this and that, but I'm eating this, and so I'm a better crow. So he was thinking like this, and the boys kind of encouraged that. But one day, some swans came flying from across the ocean. Big, beautiful swans with a slow, graceful movement that could fly great distances at great speed. And they came, and the boys, seeing the swans, said to the crow, oh, you're better than these birds. These birds are nothing compared to you. And because this crow was infected with pride, he thought, that's right. I am better than those swans. And I can outfly them. And so the crow decided to challenge the swans, you know. You're nothing. I can outfly you, and I can do so many maneuvers. I can fly this way, that way, backwards, do dips, dives. You know, what can you do? And Swan said, well, we can simply do as we've been taught, fly in a straight line, flapping our wings. Oh, that's nothing, he said. Let's have a contest. And said, okay, they had a contest. So they flew out over the ocean. And that crow was like dipping and diving and doing flips and flying in all kinds of fantastic ways. And the other crows were, all right, you know, this is great. You know, we're defeating the swans. And the swans were just gracefully going along in a straight line. But at one point, the swan decided to use their speed and they zoomed ahead. And they were way ahead, way out in the ocean, over, you know, ahead of the crow. And the crow was trying to keep up. But he began to get a little tired. And he was tired from doing all the fancy flying. And he could barely keep himself above the water. And he realized that when he looked back that he can't see land anymore. He knew he was in trouble. Because there's no place to land. And so therefore he called out to the swan, wait, please help me. I'm tired. I can barely stay above the waves. If I fall down there, some aquatics will eat me. And the swan turned to him and at first gave him a little hard time for being so proud, but then saved him and took him back to the shore. And this crow realized that actually because of my association with this wealthy family, I thought more of myself than I actually was. And therefore, I was wrong. Fortunately, the swans, they had good character. They could forgive the crow and they took him back to safety. But the lesson of this story is that because the crows were associating with and taking the remnants of food of that wealthy family, they started to think in a very proud way about themselves and started to imitate the wealth and power and prestige of that family as opposed to following the example of the great swans and the humpses that they met. And so there's a little short one paragraph purport to this which brings in this lessons of anusara and anukara. And it has to do with us as we attempt to associate with Srila Prabhupada, with the previous acharyas, with his books, and present that. What is our authority? How do we overcome our faults, our tendency to become proud, our inability to follow the instructions of the great devotees? How does that all work out? So this short paragraph reads as follows. Sometimes it is seen that after becoming uplifted by receiving the mercy of great personalities, some kaka, jana, crow-like persons become proud and forget the color of their feathers. After having a little association with swan-like Paramahamsa devotees, they begin to consider themselves far superior to their peers and perhaps even equal to the Paramahamsas. Instead of anusara, following the instructions of the Lord's dear devotees, they take up the cheap practice of anukara, imitation. By taking shelter of swan-like persons, we may cross the ocean of birth and death, but if we try to imitate them, we will certainly fall down into the ocean and drown. And so that's the lesson we should take and how we should approach our own efforts to speak our realizations in the Bhagavatam class, or in discussions with each other, or in those we meet as we're trying to spread Krishna consciousness to them. We are representatives of our spiritual master and not the spiritual master ourselves. And therefore, we should repeat what we've heard. If we are repeating what we've heard as we've heard without trying to make it up or be fancy or do dips and dives or fly backwards or whatever, then we can be said to be anusara, following the instructions of our devotees and therefore authorized to share our knowledge, our experience in Krishna consciousness with others. There, that's how we become qualified. Now, as I mentioned a little earlier, there's another aspect to this qualification, and that is dealing with the subject matter of knowledge itself. The knowledge that we have been given in the Srimad Bhagavatam is described as the mature fruit of all the Vedic literatures. And especially when we get to the 10th canto, where there's Krishna's pastimes are described, very confidential knowledge is being given. And so that knowledge has to be handled very carefully. If a government has confidential secrets, they have a policy that's kind of like need to know only. If you don't need to know the knowledge, then it's withheld from you. And I think also, even in our own personal lives, our personal relationships, there are certain aspects of knowledge about us individually or about our relationship with someone that's confidential. It's not meant for everyone to know. And so the Supreme Personality of Godhead also has confidential aspects that not everybody needs to know or can understand. When the Bhagavatam was being spoken by Srila Sukadeva Goswami on the bank of the Ganges, when Maharaj Parikshit was fasting till death, there was a mixture in the audience. Some great devotees of the Lord, there were jnanis there, there were impersonalists there as well. Therefore, our acharyas have described that Sukadeva Goswami did not mention certain confidential things confidential knowledge about the Lord, because he knew that it couldn't be appreciated by everyone in the audience. And so that's another reason why knowledge might be restricted. Restricted on the basis of the qualification of the speaker, but also restricted on the qualifications of the hearer. It's not that the most confidential parts of all of our teachings are what are our subject matter at a public program, Krishna Consciousness 101. Because these things may confuse persons and cause misunderstanding or worse, cause offense being made to the Lord. So that's another reason why sometimes knowledge can be restricted. So that's something about qualification. Any questions on qualifications before we go on to other aspects here? Anyone? Yes.
Before you were explaining something, it was I also had the same understanding. It was Sringi who cursed Maharaj Parikshit, and that was that is sort of an indicative that Brahmanas started using their powers, misusing their powers. But Maharaj Dashrath was also cursed, and he did not have like any fault in that, but he was cursed. So why this particular incident we take as indicative of this kind? Like Maharaj Dashrath was cursed to die in separation, in agony of separation of his son.
So generalizing your question could be, why do seemingly undeserving people, why are they cursed in different ways at different times, like Maharaj Dashrath cursed to die in separation from his son Ram? Seems like that. Well, as it turns out, curses are a way that the Lord's pastimes or his Leela sort of are accelerated to happen. I mean, we're reading in the Bhagavatam and Atlatra about Kamsa, King Kamsa. He heard the voice that he was destined to die at the hand of the eighth child of his sister. And so even Narada Muni, because it was the eighth child, you might think, well, there's some time here. And Vasudev, the father of Krishna, was like explaining, well, we have some time. But when Narada Muni heard that, he came there and he explained to Kamsa that, well, actually, you know, eight, you can count eight two ways. You can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or you can count 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So, and it could be any of the children, you know, that could be the eighth child. And so the whole point was to accelerate the pastimes and the appearance of the Lord. So curses are used like that sometimes. And Mars Dashrath being cursed also was a way in which Lord Brahma's pastimes could unfold in the world. And so curses are sometimes used like that. Of course, there are people that get cursed for doing things wrong. Maharaj Dasrath might be considered not having done something wrong, but for the purpose of the Lord's pastimes, these are there. Okay, well, there's a couple of other things about knowledge that are covered in these verses. And one is in the... there's a statement Prabhupada makes here in the sixth verse, in the purport. He says, to hear and explain them, talking about the teachings, to hear and explain them is more important than reading them. And this is Shravanam Kirtanam. To hear and explain them is more important than to read them. So that's why we come together for a class. You may remember, some of you that have been around for some time, that a devotee named Krishna Kshetra was here doing a semester teaching at the university, like Krishna Sharanam was last year. And he was explaining that our tradition is a tradition of commentary. Not just that the Srimad Bhagavatam verses are there, but there's commentary on those verses by all the previous teachers. And so the reason why we meet together, despite our disqualifications, as I was explaining before, is that if we are anusar, if we're actually following, great benefit can be had by, in a group like this, studying the shastras and hearing questions, answering questions, clearing doubts, discussing our realizations. That is the way to get the best knowledge out of the text. Not just by reading it, going off by ourselves and reading it. No, because commentary is very, very important. And I've seen this myself, personally. I was in Shridham Mayapur one year, and Srila Prabhupada was there. And this was before the festival. I went early, before all the devotees from around the world came to gather for the festival. I got a chance to go there early to serve some sannyasis that were on the GBC at that time. And when we were there, a few devotees were in Mayapur. It was an isolated place. Many people weren't living there, so people just came for the festival. So a few devotees were there. And Srila Prabhupada was giving Bhagavatam class. He came and he spoke a class. Maybe he spoke 20, 30 minutes in English. And then to my great surprise, he turned to Jayapataka Maharaj, Jayapataka Swami, and he said, now you explain in Bengali to the Bengalis that were there. I was shocked because I thought, if he had asked me to speak in English, summarize what he said, I wouldn't have known what to say. But Jayapataka Maharaj, who's a born English speaker, he asked him to speak in Bengali and explain what he had said to everybody. He was exhibiting this Shravanam Kirtanam. First we hear, and then we repeat. And then the knowledge becomes situated in our heart very strongly. And so that's part of what we do here, and I've seen it. Kalakanta, I've seen the schedule that every now and then some of you get to give the class, and as you go through the program, you get the chance to present your realizations, hear other people, questions, and that's a way for everyone to advance. This is how we do this, the Shravanam Kirtanam process. Yes?
In the third canto of the Bhagavatam, Kapila Dev gives a definition of sound. And there's three qualities to that definition. One of the qualities is that sound indicates speaker, which means that it indicates the quality of consciousness. So it's a little slightly different from the definition as we know it of sound in the Western world. So when we hear somebody speak, the consciousness of the speaker also is carried within the sound. So therefore, it also makes an impact on the hearer. So it's like in real time. Whereas when you read, the potency is that the consciousness is there, but it's not like in real time as you'd be hearing it. So therefore, hearing is much more preferred than actually reading.
Thank you very much. That's very, very interesting, because that goes right into the next subject matter. We can hear the consciousness of the speaker, but then what is our qualification as a hearer or a questioner in that kind of situation? A lot of times, unfortunately, what you find is that, say like during a Bhagavatam class or something like that, after the class, there's some challenging question, you know. Oh, you said, you know, blah, blah, you know. I've actually been quite shocked sometimes at some of the things that have come out. I even spoke up one time and said, "Oh, that's not a way to, you know, to approach the speaker," because that sound indicates our consciousness as being sort of unsubmissive or challenging, and that's not the way to receive this knowledge, and that's also explained in these verses, in text number 5 in the purport. It says that those who listen to the Bhagavatam may put questions to the speaker in order to elicit the clear meaning, but this should not be done in a challenging spirit. One must submit questions with great regard for the speaker and the subject matter. So that's how our consciousness has to be when we are, if we're a qualified hearer of the Bhagavatam as well. We can't have this sort of a challenging mentality, because then what happens? We block any real knowledge that comes in. A lot of times I think, it's happened to me, I know, that when a speaker is presenting and I get a question in my mind, say right at the beginning of class or something like that, I don't hear anything else that happened in class. Because all I got is that question in my mind, you know, like it's there. And I don't hear any. My question may have been answered in the class, but I didn't hear it because of my own oral reception. My own consciousness was blocking it out. So there's a qualification of the hearer as well as a qualification of the speaker. And then finally, the last element here is that Suta Goswami is being praised for being knowledgeable in all the scriptures. He's being praised as being knowledgeable in all the scriptures. It says here that not only should one be freed from all vices, but one must be well-versed in all relevant scriptures or in the Vedas. The Puranas are also parts of the Vedas, and the histories like the Mahabharata or Ramayana are also part of the Vedas. The Acharya or the Goswami must be well acquainted with all these literatures. Okay, so what are the main literatures? And I saw Amrita Kaili earlier, and I would like to ask her this question. But what are those literatures which are... Oh, there she is. Okay. What are those literatures that we must be most familiar with if we are going to present our realizations of Krishna consciousness? And I'll give you a hint. It probably has to do with what you did when you were in India. So do you want to...
Srila Prabhupada recommended that we study these four core books that are in a Bhakti Shastri. And that's the Bhagavad Gita, the Sri Isha Upanishad, the Nectar of Devotion, and the Nectar of Instruction. Well, I thought I had read the Bhagavad Gita before. That was one of my biggest realizations, was that once we studied Bhagavad Gita, there was so much there that, I mean, even in the first chapter, like what we've already gone over in the first chapter here, there's so much information that you, when trying to read alone, doesn't even register. And when you have teachers And we had a variety of teachers for Bhagavad Gita. So you see it from different points of view, and people give you different personal experiences that relate to the Shastra. And it was a very deep experience of studying the books. And I so much appreciated having such qualified people to share it with me, because I couldn't have understood it on my own. So that was probably my biggest realization, I guess.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Very good realization. The different knowledge, our knowledge of the scriptures is enriched. I think that might have been the word she was searching for. It was enriched by the realization of others. And that is how we can actually come to know. And, of course, the scriptures she mentioned are, again, were Bhagavad Gita, Shirsha Upanishad, Nectar Devotion, and Nectar of Instruction. Now, those comprise the Bhakti Shastri course. You take that course initially, you get your Bhakti Shastri degree, and then you go on to that. And these are all levels of study of the scripture that are given to us by Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. We study Bhakti Vaibhava, which is the Srimad Bhagavatam. The first six cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam are studied in the Bhakti Vaibhava degree program. And then there's the Bhakti Vedanta degree program, which is the last six cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then there's Bhakti Sarvabhauma, which is Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. And so these are the literatures specifically that we need to familiarize ourselves with. And if we read Prabhupada's books, just like we did today, we got a reference to the Purana, what was it? The Vaivavirya Tantra. So there are different scriptures that are referred to by Prabhupada in his purports. So when Prabhupada says everything's in my books, then that's true. All the knowledge we need to be conversant with will be in these books given to us by Srila Prabhupada. And that way we can follow, again, we don't have to imitate by going out and trying to find some esoteric shastra that gives us some knowledge that when we go and speak, we're saying something new and different. Oh, wow, that person said something new and different. I never heard anything like that before. That shouldn't be our goal when we're sharing Krishna consciousness with others, but to speak as a swan flew just as he was taught by his predecessors, we should also speak as we and following their predecessors. And actually, there is a danger. So many books are being printed, and I was in India just recently, and someone was saying that one book in particular, Nityananda Charitamrita. I don't know if you've seen that book, but someone was saying that book comes from one of the unauthorized sampradayas. And so we might be searching for nectar to get it, but then what we actually get is something that's not part of our sampradaya. So there's some dangers out there. Yes.
I had a friend once that we were at Rath Yatra, and he said, he was passing out pamphlets, just pamphlets on Krishna consciousness to different people. And one person rejected it. So he got angry, and he said, "You're lost," he said to this person. And then as the person was walking away, he screamed, "Hare Krishna." And then I said, "Prabhu, why did you do that? I mean, you just insulted this person." He said, I just started their spiritual life," he said. "Because I just chanted Hare Krishna to them." And he said, "Yeah, but you just said you're lost. You just totally insult this person. Why did you insult them?" He said, "Why do I care what they think of me? I just started their spiritual life." So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I've actually seen that before. And it has a lot to do with the hearer and the speaker. And the hearer is not really ready to hear anything.
It was a little different topic. Maybe you want to ask.
Right. Well, obviously, I yeah, well, I think that that person might want to review the story we talked today about difference between Anusara and Anukara. We need to be... The first quality of knowledge that's described in Bhagavad Gita is humility. And so that is the platform from which we begin to instruct others. Srila Prabhupada talked about this same kind of situation. And he described that what the Vaishnava will do is they'll take a straw between their teeth, which in Vedic culture is a symbol of, you know, seeing oneself as a very lowly and humble person. And he'll beg the person, "My dear sir," and he'll flatter the person, "You're such a great person, you're so learned and everything. Please take to Krishna consciousness." We see the example of Lord Nityananda, the personality of Godhead himself, who went humbly door to door begging people, "Bolo Krishna, Bhaja Krishna, chant Hare Krishna," you know, in a very humble way, approaching others to spread Krishna consciousness. That is going to be, we need to follow that example, not others, which could be seen coming from our pride, just like you're saying. If I'm telling something to somebody and they don't accept it, they don't want to listen to what I have to say, then my pride comes between me and them. And then I act like that, frustrated. And if I, in that state of mind, a conscious mind, say Hare Krishna, then what's the consciousness going to be when they actually hear that? They're going to think, oh, these people, you know, they're, you know, just like some of us think about people that shout things different ways on campus or something. But see, if you do that, an interesting thing will happen. And it happened over time in Los Angeles. Every year in Rath Yatra in Los Angeles, there's a group of people that come out. They wear these cow suits and they have big placards. "You're going to burn in hell," you know, and they're screaming all kinds of things as the Rath Yatra goes. But what happened after a number of years, the devotees noticed that with the cow suit on and everything, still, like, some of the, they were like taking prasadam and everything like that. So over the years, they became won over just by us not. If we got out there and fought with them every year, would they ever take prasadam? You know, but there's a responsible to just ignore, tolerate. That's the position of the devotee: humility and tolerance. And those should be the platform on which we have our preaching based on. You wanted to add something to that?
Why is it that although we are, at least speaking for myself, that although we are unqualified, but yet we are sitting on the Vyasa Sun and speaking? You'll notice that in this text number 6, the sages refer to the Puranas and the Itihasas. They say you learn it in the Puranas and the Itihasas, because his father, Ramaharshan, was a disciple of Vyasadeva, and he had studied the Puranas and the Itihasas. But he wasn't so well versed in the other aspects of the Vedas. And that's why in the next text, text number 7, they say, you know, although you are well learned in the Dharma Shastra, but yet you have had association of those that are well learned in the other Vedas, so therefore you're qualified to speak. So because Sutta Goswami has had association of other sages and his association with his father having studied the Puranas, therefore he's also qualified to speak, although he's not learned in those subject matters. Right, he was killed by Lord Balaram.